last week was a very special birthday. It was the 125th birthday of Dr. Ambedkar. Unfortunately, he passed on quite a while ago, but if he was alive, it would have been his 125th birthday. And there's been big celebrations in India and in our movement, even in the UK and in Europe. So I wanted to say a bit more about him this evening. So first of all, before I start, I thought I'd put a question to you, which is, if you think about it, who are the world's great reformers? Who've made a real difference to world history?
Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
William Wilberforce.
Yeah.
Ambedkar.
Yes. Well done. You get a star prize. Not hard to guess. But actually, it's interesting, if you do ask people about that, you know, there's certain names that come to mind, and very rarely does Dr. Ambedkar sort of trip off the tongue. Actually, he's up there with the greatest world reformers, but not a lot of people know about him. He's becoming more popular now. There was one day where the Google search engine had his face on, which was quite remarkable. It was his birthday, wasn't it? Yeah, okay. Yeah, they didn't do it this year. Anyway, not that I noticed, but I thought we'd made it when Dr. Ambedkar appeared on Google search. But yes, if you go to India and you ask anyone in our Sangha there who are the world's great reformers, they will look at you as if you're completely mad and say, well, Baba Saheb Ambedkar, obviously. There was actually a little group and... on an order convention, it was a mixture of Indian and Western order members, and we were asked who inspired us. And some of us were sort of, you know, coming out with, you know, I don't know, my first teacher at school or anything. And it was such an odd question to ask an Indian, because they all said, Dr. Ambedkar, why would there be anyone else? And if you go to India, what you'll see is everywhere, you'll see a picture or a statue of Ambedkar. I noticed he was even in Slumdog Millionaire in the background, unfortunately in the police station, but we'll overlook that. But yes, so you'll see his picture. So this is the quite, should we call it, stylized picture of Dr. Ambedkar. And this is an actual photo of Dr. Ambedkar, which you can come and look at. But anyway, you'll see him quite a lot in India. It's interesting, actually, because he's not a terribly charismatic figure. He doesn't look the part. He's slightly portly. He's a very tall man, apparently, wearing a Western suit and having quite large glasses. In fact, in the stylized version that they put on Indian TV, the glasses come first. So he's not the kind of Gandhi, Indian-looking man in homespun. He doesn't quite have that sort of look. He looks like this, you know, man in a Western suit with big glasses. And you've got the stylized version, but you've also, if you look at the picture, which I think this picture illustrates, you'll see that he's got this very intense look, a look of great conviction, and also sometimes some sadness. I think a man who knew how far he had to go. You know, he's not got a terribly friendly stare, actually, in his picture. So you could imagine going to one of our centres in India, and maybe it's a tiny hot room in a block of flats, or in a shopping centre, or maybe it's a tin roof structure or a bamboo marquee in a slightly scrubby field. We've got a centre in a very well-maintained complex of brick buildings, which is a training institute for young people from disadvantaged backgrounds. Or a tin roof, open-sided shelter down a back street in Mumbai. All these places are our centres in India. And if you go to what's called a programme, or what we would call a class in India, the first thing that happens is there'll be a lot of introductions and a lot of offering flowers. Actually, the first flowers that are offered are to the picture of Dr. Ambedkar, and then the picture of Sangharakshita. And you'll hear a talk, and after a while you might get to hear people's stories, maybe if you talk one-to-one to people or ask people questions. And what you'll find is that most people, not all people, but most people are from what's called a Dalit background. So a Dalit means oppressed. And it's people who are formerly known as untouchable within the caste system. So if you don't know much about the Hindu society, Hindu society is divided into castes with the Brahmins at the top and the Shudras at the bottom, and all sorts of castes in between, all sorts of subdivisions. And the untouchables are lower than the Shudras. They're untouchable because they're outside the caste system completely, and their touch is deemed polluting by the higher caste. Even sometimes it's said that their shadow is polluting to the higher caste. It's a system of what Dr. Ambedkar called graded inequality. And the castes are fixed, so when you've been born into a particular caste, you can't get out of it. And it's, well, traditionally anyway, it's regarded as wrong to even try and get out of it. Traditionally, it determined your job, who you marry, who you're friends with, where you can walk, what water you can take, who you can speak to, what kind of food you eat, whether you can get an education or own land, or even go to the temple. So it governed every aspect, and to a certain extent it still does govern every aspect of life. And what you'll hear when you go to India is sometimes you'll hear stories of extreme violence done towards the lower castes, and they're very, very shocking. Actually, I think the one of the advantages and disadvantages of social media is now if a caste atrocity happens in India, someone takes a picture and then it just goes viral, and so you get pictures of the caste violence, which are very distressing. There's some, in a way it's good because it's sort of saying what actually happened. In another way it's terrible, because there's some things I've seen on those which are images that will stay with me forever and I wish I'd never seen. But actually, the extreme violence is there to keep in place a system that's far more sinister, in a way, because it's there to keep in place a system of insidious undermining, the denial of basic rights, just the ordinary things like, you know, whether someone's going to, things we take for granted, like whether someone's going to cut your hair. You know, you could go to a barber shop and they won't cut your hair. Or you'll be whether you can rent accommodation, or whether that trust that if you go to the police they'll take your story seriously. You know, if you're from that kind of background, a Dalit background, you just don't have that confidence, you know, that people are going to listen to your story. So your access to justice is denied. You know that when people know your name, they won't help you. So some of our Sangha practice under extremely difficult circumstances, in poverty. Also, I've heard a lot of stories about families who are not supportive of their Buddhist practice, particularly, I usually hear women's stories, actually. It's a good thing about being a woman. I don't know what it's like being a man, but I know about being a woman, you can always sort of hear women's stories. I don't know whether it's just women who like to talk to each other, but anyway, that's a happy thing. And, you know, just ordinary things like a woman was telling me that one day she wanted to go to a class, like a day retreat. When she came back home, her husband had locked her out because she hadn't cooked his lunch. And he locked her out, you know, it's not safe for an Indian woman on the streets. And, you know, he locked her out all night. But you hear those stories. But actually, in a funny kind of way, that's not the impression that you're left with. The impression you're left with is actually an incredible amount of positivity and joy. There's a real sense in the Indian Sangha that we can change things. There's a sort of fighting spirit and an interest in what we can do, and colour and life. Colour in the sense of people's enthusiasms, but also colour in the sense of people's clothing. I do love saris. I think they're wonderful things. So there's this sense of kind of love and joy and going outwards and enthusiasm for life. Last time, I often have my birthday in India, actually, and one of the things you'll find if you have your birthday in India is that everybody wants to feed you a piece of cake. So I went to give a talk at a centre, and I think I had 150 people giving me a bit of cake. That was how many were there. It seemed to go on forever. And the other thing to warn you about is that they like to get the cake and smear it on your face. You just have to go with life sometimes. It's just useless to resist. And there's a real sense of people, so the other thing I've noticed in the Indian Sangha is that there's a real value of education. I think they're shocked actually about the Western attitude often to education. You don't take it terribly seriously. When a friend of mine came to my parents' house and looked around at all the books, and he said, "What have you done with your life, Vajratara? If I was from your family, I would have written 4 books already." Thanks. I spent most of my education, you know, chatting with my friends at the back of the class. Or yes. So yeah, there's a real sense of personal responsibility and enthusiasm and hope. And if I was to sum it all up in one word, I would say there's a lot of sense of dignity in people. I think that people really carry their own dignity in a way that I find deeply moving, actually, and quite humbling to myself. So yes, and it's infectious. It's very joyful to be in India. People really love going to the Indian Sangha because this sort of sense of enthusiasm is so infectious. So what's behind this? What's behind all of this hope and positivity and enthusiasm in spite of very difficult circumstances is Dr. Ambedkar. So who was Dr. Ambedkar? Well, Dr. Ambedkar himself was born into untouchability 125 years ago. But he benefited from his father being in the army. He became the first Dalit to complete his higher education. So because his father was in the army, he got an access to education. And eventually he became what he termed the most educated man in India. So he had sponsorship from the Maharaja of Baroda, and he got an MA and PhD in economics at Columbia University, and an MA and PhD in economics in the LSE in London. And he became a barrister at law at Gray's Inn in London. He worked seriously hard, like, to do that. Apparently he used to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and work for his exams when he was at school. And with this education, he's a very, very bright, hard-working man. He could have settled down to live a comfortable life in any country. But he had this burning question. He had this burning question, which was how to eradicate caste, how to eradicate untouchability. And he tried various political, economic and social strategies. So I'll just tell you about a few of those because I think they're quite interesting in themselves. So one of them was what's called the Chowder Tank action. So traditionally, Dalits were not allowed to use the same water source as the other villagers for drinking or for anything. So there was a tank, which we'd call a reservoir. There was a small reservoir for the villagers. And Dalits were not allowed to take water from the tank until 1927, when the local municipality opened that tank to all the local people. But there was a lot of resistance from the higher caste Hindus for the lower caste to drink out of that water. So Dr. Ambedkar led 3,000 Dalits to the tank to drink. So it's a very simple action. All they went is in a procession, went to the tank, kind of leaned over the side and just drank some water. So human beings drinking water. But this was totally revolutionary. It was totally revolutionary for Dalits to use that water source. And there was an extremely violent response from the higher caste Hindus because their water had been polluted by the untouchables. So how do you purify a water source that's been polluted by your fellow man? Well, in the Hindu system, what you do is you pour in 108 pots of yogurt, 108 pots of milk, 108 pots of cow dung, and 108 pots of cow urine. So, obviously, that's going to make it so much cleaner than a load of human beings coming to just drink some water. That shows you the mad, unexplainable weirdness of the caste system and how inhuman it is, really. And I think Dr. Ambedkar was really shocked at that response, and also from the violence towards that the group of people. He did things like he became law minister of the newly independent India, and he established the Finance Commission of Independent India, and he helped establish the Reserve Bank. And through his position over the years, what he developed was this system of reservations, so that that you'd be ensured that some Dalits had access to jobs in the government sector and in education. And he also founded various political organisations and became chair of the board that drafted the Constitution of India. And the Constitution of India is based on Buddhist principles. So Dr. Ambedkar drafted this constitution, it got accepted. There's this kind of surreal moment where they congratulate, you know, the chair of the board who drafted the constitution, which was him, and all the people who helped write it. And he gives a kind of acceptance speech where he says, well, you know, it's a great constitution, but to be honest, it just depends how we're going to implement it. And he's already looking like, you know, here it is, it's a great constitution, what are you going to do? After that, he tried to bring through Parliament something called the Hindu Code Bill, which was going to outlaw the most oppressive aspect of Hindu law, particularly in relation to women. And basically, it got stalled. It got stalled by the government. And this precipitated a great internal crisis for Dr. Ambedkar, because even though he had this wonderful, India has this wonderful constitution, and he could bring in positive change by law, but with the social problems in India and the prevailing attitude to caste and to women, he called it a palace on a dung heap. And he left politics. He realised that they needed more. He said, history bears out the proposition that political revolutions have always been preceded by social and religious revolutions. The emancipation of the mind and the soul is a necessary preliminary for the political expansion of a people. So he realised that what was needed was a change in heart and soul, mind and soul. I'm sure Heart and Soul is a song in the 80s. Yeah. Mind and soul. Mind and soul. So he saw that basically caste has its roots in mind. It doesn't have its roots in law. It has its roots in mind. It's a disease of the mind, as he called it. And he said that what the mind creates, the mind can undo. So he needed, he realised that what was needed was more than political change. He wanted a free and just society. And he saw that law can help, but it won't get to the bottom of the problem. He talked about, you know, laws allowing Dalits to drink water, to own property and to join any trade. But he also said, but if they try and do these things, they'll just get beaten. People will always abuse the system. And if you don't eradicate those kind of divisions and antagonisms at the root, which is mind, they'll just rear up in other forms. And actually, that's what we're seeing now. You know, I'm sure some of you have been following the American elections and looking at things like Donald Trump, the rise of Donald Trump, and realizing what incredible antagonism and hatred there is, even in what's supposed to be a very progressive society. It's sort of lurking there under the surface, and waiting for its chance to be expressed and to come out. So we're seeing at the moment the rise of intolerance, very kind of fanatical nationalism and religious extremism. And this is because of a consciousness that is divided. And when there's a divided consciousness, we look for blame. When something goes wrong, It tends to the blame tends to fall on whoever the minority is at that moment. So, you know, it used to be the Jews and now it's the Muslims. So we have to have something more than policy. We need a practice. We need a practice of morality or ethics. So he said for a free and just society, we need liberty, equality and fraternity. And he said he got those values not from the French Revolution, but from my master, the Buddha. And he said the basis of all of liberty, equality and fraternity comes from fraternity. And he said fraternity is really another word for metta or maitri, loving kindness, as we're all familiar with. He said fraternity is primarily a mode of associated living, of conjoint communicated experience. It is essentially an attitude of respect and reverence towards one's fellow men. So that's the root of a free and just society. It's an attitude of respect and reverence towards one's fellow men. And he had a vision of a free and just society, a vision, if you like, of a pure land, what he called a pure land, Prabuddha Bharat, which is based on democratic values. And he said, democracy is more than a political machine or form of government. It is even more than a social system. It is an attitude of mind or a philosophy of life. And he thought that in order to have that kind of philosophy of life, in order to have maitri and fraternity, liberty, equality and fraternity, we need religion. We need religion because it transforms the mind, not just policy. Not just giving rules. He said religion must be a matter of principles only. It cannot be a matter of rules. The moment it degenerates into rules, it ceases to be religion, as it kills the responsibility which is the essence of any truly religious act. It's a very, very interesting statement, actually, that responsibility is the essence of every truly religious act. It's something that actually we look at a bit in our retreats on ethics at Tiruvannamalai. It's not enough to just be given rules that we blindly follow. We have to really feel it. We have to feel that respect and reverence towards one's fellow men. We can't just have, you know, even the wonderful Buddhist five precepts just imposed on us. And he thought it was Buddhism itself that teaches those values, that teaches the values of maitri, of liberty, equality and fraternity. And it teaches those values not as rules, but it teaches us how to transform our mind itself, the root of inequality, the root of oppression and caste. And he thought that transforming the mind is transforming society. It's the only thing that can transform society. And the thing that he appreciated about Buddhism is that it has as its very heart an ethical system, that you can't take ethics out of Buddhism, which is why, of course, in the Metta Bhavana, we put the person that we're not feeling quite so loving towards in the fourth stage. Because we can't have metta so far, but then if you're not a Buddhist, you can forget it. You've just fallen off the edge. That doesn't work in Buddhism. Morality, he said, Buddhist religion is nothing if not morality. What God is to other religions, morality is to Buddhism. So after a lifetime of interest in Buddhism, he embraced Buddhism in 1956 with 380,000 of his followers. And quite a few more became Buddhists over the next few days. Now, it's interesting because very recently there's been a program about Dr. Ambedkar and the Dalits converting to Buddhism on BBC World Service, which is a really interesting thing to listen to. It's got one of our order members speaking on it. And in that program, the journalists called Dr. Ambedkar's move a political move. And to a certain extent it was. It did have political implications. But I don't think for Dr. Ambedkar it was just purely a political move. He said there are two aspects to conversion, social as well as religious, and material as well as spiritual. So he definitely saw that, you know, he wanted people to convert to better themselves. But the story didn't end there. And he himself said, look, you know, I'm a very educated man and I won't be held back by my religion. But he said that for him, actually converting to Buddhism was a purely spiritual act. And what I find very interesting about Ambedkar is that through all the social inequality and the fight in society, he saw that society is there to serve the development of the individual and the development of mind. And he kept that vision that actually it wasn't just a political move or a social move. It was actually about, it didn't end with the transformation of society. The transformation of society was to enable the individual to spiritually develop. So he says, although society is necessary for the individual, mere social welfare cannot be the ultimate goal of religion. According to me, individual development should be the real aim of religion. And he said, the basic idea underlying a religion is to create an atmosphere for the spiritual development of the individual. And he himself was a deeply religious man. I think that's often missed out. Maybe he doesn't look like the religious type. I think that's why I like Dr. Ambedkar so much, you know. He's not wearing a dhoti and he's not, he doesn't class himself as a great spiritual leader. But he was, actually. And he was quite into the arts and culture. He was a lifelong learner, Dr. Ambedkar. And he spent quite a part of his life painting the Buddha. And apparently he's carving a big sculpture of the Buddha as well. He said, whatever good things I have in me or whatever have been the benefits of my education to society, I owe them to the religious feelings in me. And I think this really makes us ask the question, what is progress? Because for Dr. Ambedkar, it wasn't just material progress, but a progress meant an educated mind, a transformed mind, developing people of good character and personal transformation. And he thought that individual transformation and transformation of society come together. So it certainly wasn't just about the Dalits becoming middle class, basically. And his message has worked. That's what's really interesting about Buddhism and Dr. Ambedkar, is there's been this whole peaceful revolution not many people know about, but it's actually even reflected there in the statistics. So I've only got the 2011 census, but if you look at the figures, the Buddhist Dalits come out highest in terms of literacy, and that's male and female literacy, work participation, and the sex ratio of 0 to 6-year-olds, which, if you need that interpreting, basically means female infanticide. And in the Buddhist Dalit population, it is as it should be, which is about, you know, there's as many girls born as there are boys, if you see what I mean. So why is he important for us? Well, he's important for us because he shows that change is possible by spiritual means. That it is possible to have a peaceful revolution, even in one generation. And that's quite a significant thing, looking at what's happening in the world at the moment and the conflicts that are arising in the world. It's to give us confidence that change is possible by spiritual means. And I think this really challenges us as Western Buddhists or people who are interested in Buddhism, that we tend to think in, particularly in Europe, maybe America too, that religion is a private affair. One shouldn't really discuss it in public. Maybe we've got images of people on street corners trying to hand you leaflets or kind of, as it's called, push religion down your throat. And we're naturally very wary of that, and for good reason too. But it doesn't have to just sort of begin and end with us. I know that before I was a Buddhist and quite youthful and idealistic, you know, I wanted to change the world. And I still want to change the world, actually. I've still got that in me. And I think We mustn't think that if we become, if we enter some sort of religious group or become a Buddhist, we've got to kind of drop that. Oh, no, it's all about transformation of mind and my own meditation. We don't have to drop that idealism. It is also about changing the world. You know, let us live in a better world. It would be great. And I think also in our society, there's a kind of gravitational pull of individualism and our own private sphere. As the world becomes more complex, the demands upon us can't become more complex. We hear all sorts of information about what's happening in the world in a way that the last generation just didn't. You know, we can retreat into our own private sphere very easily. And for natural reasons, because it keeps us sort of safe from this kind of barrage of information. But Dr. Ambedkar said that it's our duty, we must believe it's our duty not just to be a good Buddhist. He said, Buddhists must believe that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. That's quite a thing to think, that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. And Ambedkar's vision was not just for India. I find that very, very exciting, actually. It's not just that India needs to be transformed by Buddhism. I think he thought that Buddhism had a part to play in entering a new phase in history. Because we're at this really interesting time now where we have a choice about where we go next. My father's a journalist, and I've only just appreciated this, I have to say. When I was younger, I thought it was quite boring. But in the 70s, he wrote a book on oil, which I didn't read. And then in the 1980s, he wrote a book on the financial revolution. And it's only when I've got to this age I've realised basically he picked the key things about those decades. You know, it was oil that's transformed the world, and that's, you know, particularly from the 1970s, and the financial revolution that changed the world. And he would like to write a new book, but he said, I've got no idea what it is now. You know, what is the sort of central issue? Because he said, the world's changing so quickly, you could write a book, and by the time it's in print, it's gone out of date. No one knows which way it's going to go. And you can either feel quite depressed about that, or you can feel quite excited. We could have a world based on greed, hatred and delusion, or on contentment, love and wisdom. You know, we've got that choice. Sangharakshita said in one of his talks, actually about nuclear war, he said, planet Earth has a really wonderful opportunity, but it's at the same time, terrible position. We can either have one world spiritually at least, or no world. The choice is before us. And he was talking about nuclear war, but I think there's the other issue now which has come out, which is the environment. And I do think it is a choice between no world or one world spiritually. And in that changing world, I think Buddhism can play an essential part. It has the potential to do that. So, you know, Buddhism could be part of this new world, a world based on love and contentment and wisdom. It could be part of transformation of mind and taking out the root of oppression. And we've also got a lot of work to do reviving Buddhism in the land of its birth, because there wasn't Buddhism in India, even though it was born in India. For many, many years, there just wasn't Buddhism in India. And actually, now there is. Now there's a very flourishing Buddhist Sangha. It's possible that many more people could live a life of dignity and respect that's otherwise denied them. When you go to India and you meet the Buddhists there, you don't say namaste, you say Jai Bhim. Jai Bhim means victory to Bhimrao Babasaheb Ambedkar. And I remember once this Dharmakarani woman order member who gave a talk, an Indian woman order member, who gave a talk about what Jai Bhim meant to her. And she said, when I say Jai Bhim, it means I can hold my head up. She says, when I say Jai Bhim, it means I'm worth something. I'm free to educate myself and get a good job and marry who I want. And I'm free to spiritually progress And I'm free to reach enlightenment, the highest spiritual goal. So, you know, we could, that's part of Buddhism in India, is being people being able to say that of themselves. And us to be able to say that of ourselves too. So there's 10 million, apparently there's 10 million Buddhists in India. And most of them are eager to learn more about Buddhism because they don't have instruction on meditation or the Dharma. And they can't take full advantage of the path they have chosen, particularly outside Maharashtra. It really took off in Maharashtra. But we could do a lot more to revive Buddhism in the land of its birth. And we have this link to the Sangha who are practicing the same Buddhism as we are, the same path. So actually, I reckon it's half our Sangha. It's not half, it's a third of our order. But if you look at the numbers of, well, I only know the numbers of women, but the numbers of women training for ordination inside India is the same as the number of women training for ordination outside of India. The difference is we have about 70 private preceptors who can ordain women. They have seven, you know, so that just gives you the perspective. And the form of Buddhism that we practice really works in the Indian context too. So it really works because what we have is a real alive practicing Sangha. And Dr. Ambedkar had a very sort of progressive idea about what the Sangha should be. He said the Sangha should have at its heart a body of intellectuals, which he meant sort of educated people, or more like trained or skilled or learned people. People that we can rely on to offer what he called true and impartial guidance to others. So he thought the Sangha needed at its heart upright individuals who are ethically responsible, aware and in harmony and positive. And he said that sort of heart of the Sangha should be free to do service to the people. And this is very close to Sangharakshita's idea of the order, the Sri Ratna Buddhist order, at its best. We all have off days. That at its best, it's upright, positive, aware people who can really serve society, serve the people. So that's what the India Dharma Trust does. It sponsors people. The India Dharma Trust doesn't make big buildings or kind of glitzy Buddhas, or we don't even sponsor social projects. Karunaa is a sort of sister charity and they sponsor social projects. What we do is we sponsor people. We sponsor upright, trained, ethically responsible, aware and positive people to go and serve society. We do that by sponsoring the ordination teams who work in India, and they go all over India doing workshops, leading retreats, leading classes, seeing people who are training for ordination or who are interested in training for ordination, and they travel enormous distances to do so. So they've all got families at home, and they go and travel. You know, in India you can do a 24-hour, 48-hour train journey, no problem. So I'll go on a train, 24 hours or whatever. They'll get off the other end and they'll teach a class straight away or a day retreat straight away. I've seen them do it. So they go all over India teaching the Dharma and serving the people. Offering true and impartial guidance. We also sponsor young men who are training for ordination, and we'd like to sponsor young women to do the same thing, so there's plans afoot for that. But we need more. We need more help, because the more money and support we can give to people, the more they'll be to go and really help spread Buddhism, to tell people what it is, to guide them on their path. And so you've all got leaflets on what the India Dharma Trust does. And I would encourage you to give us some money, basically. Because a little goes a long way in India. And what I quite like about it is it's not just about money. It's also about the fact that if you sponsor the India Dharma Trust, you'll feel part of that silent revolution. You'll be interested in it. You'll take a kind of nurturing care in what's going on in India. There's actually quite a moving story of an Indian order member who has taken out a very, very small standing order to the London Buddhist Centre Retreat Centre, Vajrasana. And obviously it's not really going to make an enormous difference, well, make some difference to Vajrasana, but he said, look, it's not about the money, it's the fact that I can never go to Vajrasana. I'll never visit Vajrasana Retreat Centre. But if I give you this money, I'll feel part of it. Mm. I thought that was such a beautiful expression of something. So, you know, you can all feel part of that peaceful revolution. And, yeah, I suppose it's also a kind of vision that we're not just our own one pocket in a sangha. We are one sangha. We're part of a bigger sangha. The world is changing and it's become more of a global community. And actually Dr. Ambedkar predicted that. He said an ideal society should be full of channels for conveying a change taking place in one part to other parts. In an ideal society, there should be many interests consciously communicated and shared. He says it's primarily a mode of associated living, of conjoint communicated experience. It's essentially an attitude of respect and reverence towards one's fellow men. So that's also how he defined fraternity, is on this basis of shared experience. And that's happening, you know, it's happening all over India, and it's happening all over the world. We're all feeling part of a global community, and what takes place in one country can really have ramifications in another part of the world. So, yeah, I thought I'd just end with a little story. Choose one story. So, yeah, I thought I'll end with just an example of one order member. It's not a particularly special story, actually. It's a very common story. But I was talking to a young order member called Ratna Kumar, who's a really wonderful young man. And he's an order member that we've really helped sponsor his growth and development. So he's originally from Orissa, which is in South India. And Ratna Kumar started life with a stigma of being a Dalit in village India. And he was telling me stories about how he couldn't sit with the upper caste children in the classroom. He was sent to the back. He couldn't play with the upper caste children in the sports grounds. He said that when he went to buy something in a shop, the shopkeepers would, he'd have to leave his money on the ground and the shopkeepers would pick it up because they wouldn't touch his skin. They'd rather touch the dirt on the floor than touch his hand. And he was unsurprisingly angry. You know, he was an angry young man. Young men do get angry, as do young women. And he was starting on that path to, you know, probably aggression and violence. Yeah, it was aggression and violence. But he heard about Dr. Ambedkar, and through Dr. Ambedkar, Dr. Ambedkar really stressed the value of education. He said, educate, agitate, organise was his slogan. So he heard about Dr. Ambedkar and it motivated him to get an education. So he applied himself and he got an education. And he was involved in social and political action for the Dalit community. But he said he realised in that something was missing. And what he realised he was missing was the Sangha. He realised that actually, in a way, the sort of social and political action route was just sort of fueling more anger, and he needed a group of people to be with him and to support him in love and fraternity. So he asked for ordination and got quite a bit of help from the order members to go on retreat. He didn't have enough money to go on retreat. And he says, well, now he still protests against injustice, but without violence and by giving a positive example to others. He said his ordination helped him take more responsibility in society, and it gave him a vision to spread the Dharma and offer the people the benefits of becoming part of a Sangha. So what he's become is an upright, genuine, solid member of society who can offer inspiration, particularly to other young people. And that's what he wants to do in his life. And it was interesting because after we had the interview, actually, we were just hanging around. I think I was moaning about something. I can't remember what I was moaning about. Anyway, I was moaning about something. And, you know, he just looked at me and very deeply, and he just said, "Vajratara, we must believe in the power of the Sangha." And that's really stayed with me. We must believe in the power of the Sangha. So I think I'll leave it there.
Thank you.